death of 37-year-old Abdirahman Abdi has hit the community hard. There were demands for answers and better police training, as well as tears and sorrow yesterday as mourners filled Ottawa's main mosque for Abdi's funeral. Meanwhile, a peaceful march is planned for this afternoon to demand justice for Abdi's death. It starts at 1:30 at Somerset Square in Hintonburg, and it will make its way to police headquarters on Elgin Street.
So, hi, Adele. The people are going to be listening to this interview, and it's almost half an hour long, about the police killing recently of Abdirahman Abdi in Ottawa. And there's a broader context which you're going to be talking about, and that is this concept of anti-Black Zionism. So I was wondering if, just very briefly, before we get into the actual interview, if you could just explain what you mean by that. What is that?
Sure. Thanks, Greg. So maybe first I'll just quickly explain Zionism. So Zionism is a particular type of discrimination and oppression that is lodged against individuals that are living with mental health issues, and sometimes even individuals who are assumed to be living with mental health issues that have very severe and damaging consequences for them. And so Zionism can be experienced by anyone of any race, any gender, any age, etc. Quickly, in terms of anti-Black racism, is a particular type of pernicious racism that is directed towards Black people, Black Canadians, etc. Anti-Black racism is global. Anti-Blackness is global. So when we put together now the concept of both anti-Black and Zionism in one sentence, or in one as a concept, what it means is a particular type of weaponizing against Black individuals who are living with mental health issues. And so, as opposed to just coming to the conversation from understanding that Zionism on its own is an issue, what we're doing is looking through a lens of anti-Blackness in order to understand the experiences of Black peoples who are also living with mental health issues.
And if I try to fight back, well, then I'm dead black. This is Greg McDougall with EquitableEducation.ca. Today, July 31st, I'm speaking with Adil, who is board chair of Across Boundaries, a mental health center in Toronto. We're speaking about the killing by police of Abdirahman Abdi, which happened in Ottawa July 24th. It was a Sunday morning, and police were called to a coffee shop where there was a disturbance. When they arrived, Abdirahman fled to his apartment building. As he got there and was trying to get inside the building, the police grabbed him and beat him unconscious. There were witnesses there. Multiple witnesses who described a brutal beating. He was left unconscious in handcuffs, face down in his own blood. It came out a few days later that when the paramedics arrived, there were no vital signs. A few things have come out since then. One being that what the police were called for to the coffee shop, the media reported what the allegations were, but in a Vice article that I saw recently, another witness came forward to say, no, that actually didn't happen. Another thing is, it was reported immediately that the family thought he was dead at the time, but then it was the next day the media reporting he died Monday afternoon. Even though it was then that the family released a statement through a spokesperson saying that the hospital told them that he'd actually been dead 45 minutes before he arrived at the hospital, that would be Sunday morning. But they didn't tell the family that he had died until the Monday afternoon. So there's questions there. One of the things in the media afterwards was the police union, or the Ottawa Police Association head, Matt Scoff, was on CBC radio saying race had nothing to do with this, and to talk like it did is, I don't know the word he said, but basically saying we shouldn't talk about race. And then that is one of the things that was in the press statement from Across Boundaries, which, Adil, maybe you could speak to.
Yeah, so firstly, Greg, thank you for having me, and we extend our deepest condolences to the Abdi family and the broader Ottawa community. So indeed, yes, that among many other things we take issue with. Primarily what we see here by the comments from the president of the police union is the omission and outright dismissal of anti-Black racism and or a conversation of race. And so while he asks us to, A, not speak about race and further suggest that it's inappropriate, these statements in and of themselves are actually baseless and have no evidence. So to date, we don't know what the outcome is. And so to suggest that racialized people, and in particular Black people, should not voice their concerns, speak to experiences of race and racism, is absurd.
You said we don't know what the outcome is. What are you referring to?
So while he's suggesting that race is not an issue here, we in fact don't know that race was not an issue here, right? So to suggest that race is not an issue without it's premature. Quite clear that race, for many reasons, is not just an issue, but is a core issue and is fundamentally at root in this situation.
I think when you said outcome, you might have been referring to the Special Investigations Unit investigation.
Yes.
I omitted that when I was describing what had happened. So the Special Investigations Unit was called in. Two of the police are subjects of their investigation. And also, I didn't mention that Abdi Rahman was a 37-year-old male originally from Somalia, and also has been reported to have mental health issues. Yeah, so, and I wanted to ask, because you're the chair of the board of a mental health center for racialized people in Toronto. What do you see are the key issues in this? And like you said, this has really impacted people deeply and impacted the community deeply.
I think, of course, there are many issues, obviously, that are at play. First and foremost, it's that of Blackness and anti-Blackness, poor and deplorable policing, an inability to de-escalate a person that's living with a mental health issue. And really, what we are seeing here is that there's clearly a problem with Blackness and clearly a problem with mental health. And so we have to start to ask critical questions about what the intersection of both Blackness and mental health breeds a particular type of outcome from police services across Ontario. And I think it's really important to underscore that this isn't a new problem. So the fact that, again, I want to go back to this, the statement that was made by Ottawa, the Ottawa Police Union president, to say that conversations about race are inappropriate. In fact, what is inappropriate is deaths starting from 1978 of Black men at the hands of police services across Ontario, but specifically police services in Toronto. So I just want to quickly recall a few things here for folks that are new to this conversation. 1978, we had Andrew Evans. The following year, 1979, we had Albert Johnson. Subsequently, we've had Wade Lawson in 1988, Lester Donaldson also in 1988, O'Brien Christopher Reed in 2004, Michael Elgon in 2012, Ray L.J. Douglas in 2013, Ian Price in 2013, and more recently, we've seen Jermaine Carby and Andrew Lacroix. So I think it's absurd, given this particular history, and now a week ago, Abdirahman Abdi, so to suggest that race is not a factor is in fact its own illustration of racism, anti-Blackness, and white supremacy logic. And further, we can see how it's that kind of attitude and rhetoric that we see that manifests in day-to-day policing. Our inability to even begin to question or query the issue of race in a conversation when a community is saying, hey, this is odd for us. We have to look at how does this play out? How does this kind of discourse and rhetoric play out in the day-to-day lives of Black people? And we saw how that plays out in the day-to-day lives of Black people. We saw that last Sunday on Hilda Street. That's what we saw. And this idea that we should be waiting for the SIU and that the SIU is some general kind of fair process, let's not forget who is employed by the SIU firstly. Secondly, I also want to draw our attention to a story that was done by the Toronto Star, which looked at 3,000 plus cases by the SIU, or investigations by the SIU from 1990 to 2010. And in that, what we found was that in a 20-year period, only 16 officers had been convicted of a crime, and only 3 of those officers actually faced prison, any kind of prison time, and served specific time there. Now, let's now further complicate that. In a 25-year history with the SIU, what we also see there is that in the incidences related to Black bodies, that there's never been a decision that has been beneficial, or investigation that's been beneficial, that has released a decision that is meaningful in the context of Black life. So the fact that people aren't trusting the SIU, the fact that people aren't trusting the processes of the SIU, there's a reason for that. And it's this kind of research and data that's telling us, hey, there's an issue here. And just to sort of ensure folks know where to be able to access that actually That came out of also a report that was done by a Toronto lawyer, Anthony Morgan, in a report that's called The Civic and Political Wrongs, The Growing Gaps Between International Civic and Political Rights. So again, I encourage listeners to go back to that report and really engage with this material from a primary place.
And I know previously you were telling me that the way the SIU came into being, so the SIU is this Ontario organization that investigates when police kill or seriously injure. And you said it was in the early 90s, and it was a lot of the Black community pressuring that there needs to be something done.
And so isn't it telling that it is the Black community and some other communities who supported, but mainly and at front of this was the Black Action Defense Committee, who pushed for a process of accountability. And now to see that the labor of the Black community is what is exactly in itself being used to not serve the Black community. And that's not something new. Black communities both in Toronto and Ontario and throughout Canada have been at the forefront of many kinds of advocacy and activism work that often turns out not benefiting the Black community in many ways. So absolutely, yes. The inception of the SIU was directly from a push from Toronto's Black community and Toronto Black activists.
And of course, we don't want to forget about the mental health aspect of this. All those people that you listed, their names, who've been murdered or killed by police, I think you, at least 10 people, those are all people with mental health issues, right?
Absolutely. Those are people living at the intersection of Blackness and madness, or also referred to as mental health lived experiences.
Yeah.
So indeed, I think we have to look at how is it that mental health and or Blackness are both compounded, and what happens in that space when these two experiences and lived experiences coincide.
Yeah.
And what we see is that there's already a particular type of discourse around people living with mental health issues as, you know, quote unquote, being folks who should be fearful of, being folks that are dangerous, being folks that are erratic, that kind of really problematic, sanist kind of attitude. And then we compound that with folks, Black folks, who are seen in a very particular way. So it's in a sense, there's like a dual kind of social response that people are interacting with. Because we do see, in fact, that police are able and have capacity to de-escalate other people. And so when we ask this question, my entry point is from a point of anti-Black sanism. My point of entry to this discussion is from a specific location of Blackness at the intersection of mental health. And not the other way around, because what we know is the Black body has a particular type of outcome, and that's often one that is fatal. And we really have to underscore that experience there.
Yeah, and I want to say, I think I heard people saying, well, if Abdi Rahman wasn't a Black man, would the police beat to death someone else of a different identity? And I don't think many people can really imagine that in the same way as what happened.
I can't imagine that, certainly not based from the evidence and the names that I have read before.
Yeah.
Right? I can't imagine that. Absolutely not. No.
And another thing, this USA Today article that I had seen from December of last year, where the headline was, I think they use the term mentally ill, are 16 times more likely to be killed by police than, say, a regular person. But I think when you're talking about intersectionality, it's not, say, a white woman who's going to be 16 times more likely to be killed by police because she has mental health issues. Mm-hmm. It's an intersectional issue.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. It is intersectional, and certainly I also want to say that Black women as well quite clearly experience violence from police, as do, you know, Black women living with mental health issues, Black women generally, indigenous folks living with mental health issues, folks that are poor. It is an intersectional issue. When we're talking or approaching this issue from a MAD or mental health perspective,
yeah,
part of having intersectional conversations is having intersectional conversations with integrity and with honesty.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't really do this, add a pinch of this, add a pinch of that, blend and kind of keep going. No, this requires us to look at history. So it requires us to look back. It requires us to look within. It requires us to look forward, and it requires us to look in the immediacy. Where are we right now? Where were we? What is happening? What happened? And how do we make those changes? So being intersectional in our analysis requires a bit more work than I think sometimes what folks are ready for. Approaching mental health from an anti-Black Zionism lens does not mean we're not talking about mental health. Does not mean that we're not talking about other folks' experiences within mental health. it means what we're saying is we get that, right? Like, we get that mental health is difficult for lots of folks. We understand that in and of itself has a particular, there's a particular experience of that in the social world. And again, that's called sanism. But when we compound these experiences, how else can we look at this issue? So really beginning to look at that, and there's become a way that which intersectionality has both served as an excuse, but also served as a way to kind of really water down in some senses what we're talking about. Yeah. So a true intersectional approach begs from us that we do a bit more work.
I'm wondering what you mean when you say it's an excuse and it's a watering down.
I think what happens is sometimes we'll simply make reference to sort of intersectional or other lived experiences for folks that are living with mental health, but we won't necessarily speak to the actual facts. So let's talk about, for example, the fact that schizophrenia has been referred to as a black man's disease for decades. Let's talk about the fact that the folks who are hyper-diagnosed, over-diagnosed, poorly treated, poorly served, and left on the fringes of the mental health system are black folks. Let's talk about the fact that the people who are in community treatment orders, which is a criminalizing tool, are black folks. Let's talk about the fact that we have many black folks that are still not able to access mental health services in the ways that they would like to, mental health services in the ways that they would like to. Let's talk about the fact that we see that for many folks, and particularly young black folks, again, as highlighted, young African and Caribbean to be specific, people, as highlighted in the CAMHH study, tell us that it takes black folks anywhere up to 18 months to seek treatment.
Okay, and to jump in there, so CAMH is the Canadian Association. No, what is it?
Centre for Addiction and Mental Health.
Right, in Toronto.
So they did a study, and in that study, what they told us was it takes up to 18 months for a young black person to be able to get the care that they need. And also highlighted that often, that form of treatment first comes by way of the criminal justice system, right? So what I'm saying is we really need to be able to name these things. And I can go on and provide example after example after example. But black people and the black community and the black communities, because we are diverse, we're not a monolith, cannot continue to be, like we cannot continue to be who the mental health system benefits from. So we can't continue to be the folks who line your day programs, line your psychiatric wards, line your case management rosters, but continue to be getting poor care. So we really have to implicate the way in which the mental health system can be understood as a new plantocracy.
Well, I was just going to say, so it's obviously not just a police problem. We're talking about much broader issues that the police are just one aspect of.
Yeah, we are talking about much broader issues. But again, what I do want to underscore, because what I also won't allow to happen that often seems to happen, is that we look to blame sort of the nonprofit industrial complex and or the mental health system for issues in any of these fatal deaths. So while, yes, there's many problems, right, there's systemic problems, certainly.
But we're extremely concerned about the degree of force used by the Ottawa police, given the tragic and ostensibly preventable outcome of this interaction.
And I don't want to conflate those, right? So there's larger systemic issues, but in this context and in the context of the other individuals' names that I had said, right, it wasn't a broken mental health system that did that. It was specifically police services, and it was the ways in which police interact with black bodies and the consistent leading to black death. And that's also what we witnessed that day. We witnessed black death. Ottawa and Toronto and the nation, what we saw publicly was black death, and we should all be outraged. All of us should be outraged because of this. The mental health community, the Ottawa community, the black community, we are all implicated. We are all implicated, and particularly we are implicated when we are silenced, when we are silenced, and we're implicated when we silence the conversation around blackness in this context.
Yeah. And it's right there, right? Everyone saw it. And I was thinking when, as you were discussing these issues, just like how much can the media do when they just do a little story and they have a few little points that they kind of get across? Where does this conversation really happen, and where does the change come from?
So the conversation is happening. The conversation is happening as black people are mourning in their homes, as black people are outraged in the streets, in private, you know, text message and Facebook conversations on Twitter. The conversation is happening. We also, however, have to again look at how did the media take up this issue? How many headlines actually used race in a way that was to really name and implicate versus using race as a descriptor in the broader story. What media outlet, both locally in Ottawa and nationally throughout Canada, is asking the really difficult question? Who's doing the work to find out how else this has happened in Ottawa? So media is implicated. Media is implicated in absenting language like anti-Black racism. Media is implicated in absenting language like Blackness. And sort of really, you know, also producing another discourse, which is, again, quote unquote, you know, I've seen things that have said this mentally ill man, we don't know what was happening, which also has a certain kind of impact as well. So I think, indeed, while there's been some coverage in Ottawa and some really good coverage in Ottawa, I also think that media really needs to sit with what is our fear around language of Blackness and anti-Blackness? What are we afraid to name? Because we saw it. We saw anti-Blackness live. We saw it that day. We witnessed it.
I think maybe, and where I was going with that question also is just how we see this and we have conversations about it, and then where does that all go?
Yeah, I think that there's I've seen individuals that are demanding things like body-worn cameras and different methods and measures of accountability, I think, and better training. Yeah. We've been saying better training for decades. Better training did not stop the fatal deaths of many of those men that I mentioned. And again, I come back to better training that doesn't address anti-Black racism is useless. Better training that doesn't address how it is to approach and interact with individuals with mental health issues is not necessarily beneficial. While I think that body-worn cameras have their place, I also want to remind us that, for example, now we have the evidence. We have the evidence of what happened to Abdirahman Abdi. We've all seen it. We all saw what happened to the late Sami Yateen on the Toronto streetcar.
Yeah.
And so I want us to think about that a little bit, right? We're seeing this, and more recently we've seen James Fersillo, while getting a six year sentence, subsequently after received bail, subsequently after went home, while again we watched that. So I think we also need to be a little bit more strategic in the things that we ask for, but also really begin to understand, like, there's a different type of implication that needs to happen in the context of policing that is going beyond this. So that, I guess, what I'm doing is asking you a question back, which is certainly not for you to answer, which is, we've seen that even in the presence of footage and evidence, what the outcomes could be. And so I guess I'm saying that I don't know how beneficial body-worn cameras are. I'm not saying that they're not useful. I'm just sort of putting out another point of contention. I think certainly race-based data would be great. We are still in a time where we don't have any race-based statistics on police interactions. Police interactions that end up becoming fatal. We still don't have that. So we're not collecting that data, and we need to start collecting that data.
To add to that, it's not race-based, but a documentary that's already online, and it's going to be shown on CBC. It's called Hold Your Fire. The filmmakers actually had to go and get all this statistics or data from the different provinces. And I think maybe it was a 10-year period, and they found about 200 police killings, actual shooting killings. And I think they found about 40% of those, 40% of those were people in mental health crisis.
And so that's the data we need. We need certainly, like, in this case, we need that kind of data that looks at the fatal outcomes, particularly when mental health and race are at the forefront of these kinds of interactions. Yeah. So I certainly think that that's important. And I also think too that we also have to do, like, this inside-outside institutional policing analysis, and or sort of, you know, bring in the prison industrial complex and what's happening inside the prison industrial complex with folks that are living with mental health issues as well. So I really want to also alert people to the fact that individuals who are either in forensic types of institutions and or regular jails and prisons, who happen to be living with mental health issue, who happen to be Black or otherwise racialized, certainly indigenous folks, are also dying there.
Yeah.
And also, like, again, right, like, at the hands of these specific types of officials, like, we've seen these kinds of reports. And again, just really drawing folks' attention to that. Like, and again, to quickly sort of highlight to folks that we've seen, for example, the use of solitary confinement and or isolation disproportionately used against Black and Indigenous people, and Black and Indigenous people who happen to also be living with mental health issues, as well as, like, recent deaths within both forensic institutions as well as, again, jails and prisons, right? So ensuring to keep that in mind.
It's an interesting difference where we're talking about this subject now because everyone saw what happened to Abdirahman. Mm-hmm. And but what's happening in prison, people don't see that. And it's like you're saying, you want to draw people's attention so they know that that's happening. And they know.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I think as well, right, like, of course, you and I are talking about this in the Ottawa context because we've seen this. But I also have to underscore this by saying Black communities, particularly here in Toronto, have been talking about this since 1978 and probably even before that. Right?
Yeah.
And this particular intersection, the intersection of both Blackness and mental health. And these conversations have been happening. What's really sad is that we, because people have seen it, in a sense now it's more believable.
Yeah.
And I want to highlight the anti-Blackness in that as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So you have to consume our death, our murder publicly. For you to believe that this is a real thing that really happens and has been happening to our community and our people for a very, very long time. And so that as well, I think is challenging and it's difficult and it's rough. And so I think that's important to highlight as well, because this isn't new for us. It hasn't been new.
No.
It wasn't new. What happened on Hilda Street is something that the collective public witnessed.
Yeah. And when you say it's challenging and difficult, I know another word you used was despair.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was just thinking, yeah, like this thing, everyone is seeing it and we're seeing what, is there justice for it? And then how does that affect people? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And over, absolutely, over long periods of time, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, and I think I wish I could be hopeful. But I struggle with being hopeful. I struggle with being hopeful for my people, and I struggle with being hopeful for the mental health community, and I struggle with being hopeful for folks in Ottawa, knowing the outcome of previous SIU decisions. So I'm critically hopeful that sort of the large-scale conversation around this might lead to something different, but I'm struggling with being sort of, again, hopeful, knowing what we know about SIU decisions. And I think that that's really difficult. I think that that's really difficult as citizens of this country, especially with the SIU again that we fought for. I think that that's really difficult to be, yeah, in despair with what will be a just process, a fulsome process, and a process of accountability.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you as well. Just one really quick thing.
Yeah, yeah.
There, again, for folks who are interested in issues around anti-Blackness, some of the stuff I also spoke about today is in a community-led and driven report that Stephen Lewis prepared. And that's a 1992 report on anti-Black racism. And again, like, you can just go into Google and type in Stephen Lewis and anti-Black racism, and this report will come up. So if folks want to have a look at that, and anything else that I mentioned during this conversation, both the CAMH Center for Addiction and Mental Health Studies online, the document by Anthony Morgan is online, report that was prepared by Stephen Lewis is online. So I really encourage folks to look into that information. And thank you so much for having me, Greg.
Yeah, I think it is important that we do what we can, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We have to demand justice. We have to demand justice. We have to demand justice for Abdirahman, but also for the rest of us. We saw it happen. We've seen it happen. We've been seeing it happen, and we need to. We really, really need to think about this going forward.
So, for listeners, just to note that all the links, all the reports that Adil mentioned in this interview are online in the post at equitableeducation.ca, and also to note the audio file of this is downloadable there in case anyone wants to play it on community radio or elsewhere. Thank you.